Four nights earlier, Herndon had jokingly turned the dinner conversation from shipwrecks to topics more pleasant by declaring that if his ship ever went down, he would be under her keel. The remark had been prompted by the sinking story of another steamer 3 years back, when the captain and crew had commandeered the lifeboats, and 259 of the 282 passengers, including all the women and children, had perished. Herndon had already determined that surviving by less than honorable means was not worth a lifetime of scorn. Customary for the day, but grossly inadequate, the Central America carried 6 lifeboats, 5 of wood, 1 of metal. The night before, a heavy sea had ripped one of the wooden boats out of its davits and swept it across the deck to smash against the wheelhouse. The remaining boats each held 4 oarsmen, a helmsman, and 40 to 50 passengers, but with the strain on the oarsmen in seas such as this, Herndon could load no more than 15 or 20. As soon as the marine rounded to, he ordered away 2 of the lifeboats. Then he ordered all women and children below to don life preservers. They lowered a 3rd lifeboat, and a heavy sea smashed it against the hull of the ship. 2 boats were now in the water. 2 boats remained on the upper deck, 1 wood, 1 metal. The crew lowered the wooden lifeboat safely into the water. Chief Engineer Ashby helped launch the metal boat, but a heavy sea swamped it, and it sank immediately. Below in the main cabin, the women were instructed to strip off their layers of skirts, everything but the outside dress, then put on a life preserver. They wrapped the older children in life preservers and the babies in blankets to be held in their arms. Many of the women traveled with a great deal of money they had not registered with the purser. All of them were now advised not to carry more than 2 $20 gold pieces with them. While they were getting into the boats, observed one man from the bailing lines, there was the utmost coolness and self-control among the passengers. Not a man attempted to get into the boats. Captain Herndon gave orders that none but the ladies and children should get into the boats, and he was obeyed to the letter. The minstrel, Billy Birch, had left the bailing lines, found his wife, Virginia, and helped her with her life preserver. She bid her husband of 3 weeks goodbye. I expected that it was the intention to transfer all the passengers to the brig, otherwise I would not have left while my husband remained behind. But he told me to go, and he would soon follow. And so I went. Many of the women expected their husbands to accompany them in the lifeboats, but every man refused to leave with his wife until all the women and children had been safely ferried to the marine. 4 crewmen manned the oars of the 1st lifeboat, and at the helm stood one man Herndon knew he could trust above all others, the boatswain, John Black. As the oarsmen pushed off and dug in their oars, Virginia Birch heard Captain Herndon yell to Black, "Ask the captain of the brig to lay close by me all night for God's sake, as I am in a sinking state and have 500 souls on board, besides $1.5 million. Awaiting the women and children, 2 more lifeboats now remained at the sides of the steamer, each already beginning to fill with passengers. Before boarding in San Francisco, Thomas Badger had given his wife $16,500 in $20 gold pieces, which she sewed up in toweling in 3 parcels and laid flat in a trunk. The trunk sat in their stateroom, now in water up to Jane Badger's knees. She found the trunk, unlocked it, took out the gold, placed it in a carpet bag, threw a crepe shawl on top, locked the bag, and then had to leave it sitting on the lower berth. It was so heavy she couldn't lift it. "I left in the 3rd boat," Addie Easton later remembered. "I said, however, to Ansel, 'I don't want to go till you do.' He said, 'You had better go now,' or something of that kind. I then kissed him and said, 'I'll pray for you.' In a moment I was swinging from the deck, and when a swell brought the little boat underneath, the rope was lowered and I dropped in the bottom of the boat." One passenger described the evacuation of the women and children as a dangerous, heroic, and almost superhuman effort that can scarcely have a parallel. But the passenger also noted that through some strange and mysterious influence, there were several young and unmarried men taken in the lifeboats to the brig, leaving behind those men who had wives and children. Virginia Birch had pleaded with Ashby to allow her husband Billy to come with her, but he refused, she recalled, using insulting language. Other women, too, had pleaded with the officers to let their husbands come with them and were refused. Yet somehow in the confusion, single men now sat at their side. One of the men who boarded a lifeboat early was Judge Monson. he had applied to the first officer to allow an elderly gentleman, Albert Priest, to board that third boat. Perhaps realizing the judge was a friend of the captain, the first officer agreed, and the crew lowered the old man. I gave Mr. Priest a message to my brother in New York, Monson said later, in case I should not be saved myself. Mr. Priest said, never mind the message, come, judge, yourself. The first officer said, certainly, judge, it is your turn. All right, jump in. I immediately was lowered into the boat. A moment previous, I had not the slightest idea of leaving the steamer then. About 2 miles to the lee, when the first of the lifeboats shoved off the Central America, the Marine had drifted another mile before the lifeboats began to arrive. The crewmen had pulled on their oars for an hour and a half. Despite their weariness, the lifeboat crews pushed off and returned through heavy seas for more of the passengers. Meanwhile, the gap between the Central America and the Marine widened, the wind pushing the smaller and much lighter brig at a faster pace. Herndon would have to try to maneuver closer to the brig. The wind had somewhat subsided, and the heavier sails should now withstand even the fiercer gusts. About 4 p.m., he ordered the main spencer set, hoping to use the wind to keep the gap between the two ships from widening even more. With the new sail set, Captain Herndon told passenger Theodore Payne to take the next boat that returned. He had a favor to ask, but first he wanted Payne to go into his office and fetch his gold watch and chain. When Payne brought them to the captain, Herndon said, if you are saved, deliver them to my wife. Tell her to... But then he choked and his voice quit, and he stood silently saying nothing. When he could speak again, he asked Payne to meet with the president of the steamship company and the agents and to explain to them what had happened. After saying this much, he walked away a few steps and sat down on a bench, his head in his hands. In that position, he remained only a few moments. Then he arose and resumed giving orders, as the first lifeboat helmed by the bosun John Black had returned from the Marine. With the men pushing to fill the first of the returning boats, Billy Birch asked Ashby to allow him on the boat so he could join Virginia, and the engineer said he would do all he could, but Birch did not get onto that lifeboat. Neither did Ansel Easton secure a seat to take him to Addie. But he found a pencil and scribbled a note on a small piece of blue paper, which he folded and gave to one of the last three women to leave, asking her to please deliver it to his wife upon arriving at the brig. When the boat was nearly filled with passengers, Ashby himself went to the captain and insisted he be allowed to go to the brig in that boat. If you let me go, said Ashby, I will bring back the two boats and all the small boats that can be spared from the brig. Captain Herndon questioned whether he could trust the engineer. Ashby said, I promise you, Captain, most solemnly, that I will come back to the steamer and not desert her. He seized a rope and slid down to the boat. Captain Herndon walked forward along the rail of the steamer and shouted to Ashby, I will depend on your returning with the boats. To which Ashby replied, Captain, you may depend your life on my returning. Now that the women and children had been safely ferried to the brig, the captain and his officers no longer assisted the passengers. The only way down was to jump. When the second boat came in, a wave jammed it against the side of the ship, stoving in some of the timbers. The boat began to leak. 5 passengers and 3 firemen jumped from the steamer deck into the boat, and Captain Herndon yelled to the helmsman to shove off before more passengers could jump and swamp the boat. Perhaps the reason even more men did not jump is because they felt safer on the big ship. The lifeboat seemed so small next to the steamer. The wind had somewhat abated, and this increased their hopes that the brig soon could maneuver back to the steamer and take them all safely on board. Herndon estimated that the Central America could stay afloat no longer than mid-morning of the following day, but he wanted to provide the men with every means possible of saving themselves. Even before the last of the women had been taken from the ship, he had ordered that life preservers be brought up and distributed to all the men. Now he ordered the hurricane deck cut away. The doors ripped from their hinges, the hatch covers pulled off, the gratings removed, anything that would float, so that if the ship sank, plenty of rafts would be in the water for the survivors to cling to. The once proud steamer, her boats gone, her foremast cut down, her sails in tatters, her furniture and dishes broken, her staterooms deep in seawater, her engines long silent, now had her very decks peeled away. Just after 6 o'clock, a watchman in the rigging aboard the Central America spotted the El Dorado, a small schooner plowing through the storm toward the crippled steamer. About 6:30 that evening, Captain Stone brought the El Dorado within 50 feet of the steamer and hailed the captain. "Can I render any assistance?" Herndon called back, "Lie by me till morning, for I am in a sinking condition." "Immediately," said Captain Stone. I warned him to commence at once putting his passengers on board, supposing he had good boats, while I had but one, a small jolly boat which would not live in the high sea then running for a moment. Again the captain's reply, "No, no, lie by me till morning." Stone held as tight to the steamer as he could, but within a minute or two began drifting away. He expected someone from the steamer to throw a line for him to make fast, but in the few precious seconds that passed as the schooner swept by, no one from the steamer tried to throw a line. Captain Stone assumed that the steamer captain would rather wait until daylight to begin launching his lifeboats than risk losing men overboard in the darkness. He yelled, "Set your lights!" and by then had drifted out of hailing distance. As they moved slowly away, the seamen of the El Dorado could hear a roar of voices rising. Captain Herndon now went around his ship asking the men to stand by her till morning, that he thought he could keep her afloat if they just continued to bail. "We all agreed to do so," said one passenger. Herndon directed James Frazier to take charge of the arms chest and every half hour send up a rocket. Lights had been set on both vessels, for in a sky already darkened by storm, night was coming on. The brig Marine had drifted so far to leeward she now lay 5 miles off. Most of the women sat or stood in the water on deck, holding onto their children and onto each other, watching for the lifeboats to arrive on their second trip from the steamer. Each expected her husband to be in the next boat. Addie Easton was among those on deck. Surely, she thought, her husband would be in the first boat. But as she searched the faces, she could see that it was the bosun, John Black, steering the boat alongside, and that it held but 3 women, Mr. Payne, the engineer Ashby, and other men she did not recognize. She kept her vigil for the next boat. Ashby leaped aboard the Marine and immediately relayed Captain Herndon's request that Captain Burt work his way closer to the crippled steamer. He had been trying, said Burt, but with no main yard, no main topsail, and no jib boom, he could not work to the windward. John Black appealed to his oarsmen for a third trip and shoved off once more. Addie Easton now spied another lifeboat. Her hopes rose, and as the boat neared, her eyes combed every man. When the men in the boats had safely transferred to the brig's deck, the oarsmen refused to embark on a third trip. Ashby jumped into one of the boats, screaming an offer of $100 for any man who would get in and help pull for the steamer. One oarsman said he would return to the steamer for no pay if she were 50 miles away, but 2 men could not pull a lifeboat in those seas. The oarsmen had been in the lifeboats with no rest for 6 hours. For 24 hours prior to launching the lifeboats, they had bailed and pumped without stopping, and for nearly 2 days they had no sleep and little or no food. Plus, the 2 boats leaked. When they arrived, they knew the scene that would be waiting for them. 500 men facing death and looking at the 20-passenger lifeboats as their only salvation, and now, with the women and children gone, not even chivalry to hold them back. Finally, Ashby gave up, and with it went his promise to Captain Herndon. Only the bosun Black had yet to return from his last trip to the steamer. It was growing dark, remembered Addie, and the boatman refused to go back again to the ship. I put my face down in my hands, too wretched to speak, reproaching myself that I had not stayed with him, regretting that I had not defied captain and all when they commanded us to leave. Then someone touched her on the shoulder, and she heard the voice of Captain Burt. "Here's a letter from your husband, Mrs. Easton. It was brought by someone in the last boat." He handed her a small scrap of blue paper. "My dear wife," Ansel had written, "if the captain of the Marine will send a boat forward for me, you can give him what he will ask. I will watch for it and be on hand. Your affectionate husband, A.I.E. Addie pleaded with Captain Burt to send one of his own lifeboats to the Central America to rescue her husband. The captain told her, as he had Ashby, that his only boat could not survive in such a sea as this, especially now that darkness was setting in. "But Captain," she pleaded, "they may all die before morning. Anything, $10,000 if you will send another boat." "My dear, dear lady," he replied, "if I could send it, one should go without a cent of money. But a boat such as we have would not live a moment in such a sea. I will try to take the brig nearer to the steamer, and she will probably float until morning." "Language fails me to give even a faint description of that night," wrote Addie. "If anything, it was worse than the one previous. There were 30 women and 26 children in a cabin but very little larger than a little parlor room, and most of us sitting on the floor, while every wave dashed over the brig, and most of the time the water was several inches deep. We were all wet, and I had not one dry thread on me, but I was not conscious of my physical sufferings. My agony of mind was so much greater. The sea still ran high and the wind blew hard, but the storm at last seemed to be passing. Captain Burt continued trying to work his way closer to the steamer, his brig so badly disabled that he had to tack in a circle several miles. Addie was on deck with other women. "As we came back towards the steamer, we watched her lights flashing," remembered Addie. "Suddenly a rocket shot out obliquely. The lights disappeared beneath the waves, and all the world grew dark for me." Late that night, the sky black, the marine's lamps only dimly illuminating her flooded deck, the men and women aboard heard the creaking of oarlocks. Into the dim light glided the boat of the bosun John Black, his oarsmen beyond exhaustion, his boat beaten by the sea and filled with water. Black had left the marine for his last trip to the steamer about 6 o'clock. His boat made the steamer about 7:30. Herndon had hailed Black, who reported that his boat was stove and leaking. Herndon had directed him to keep off at 100 yards. Minutes later, Black had seen a rocket come off the Central America wheelhouse at an odd angle, not high and arcing but straight out across the ocean. Now, save for the exhausted oarsmen and the excessive seawater, Black's lifeboat was empty. He came alongside and looked up at the men and women gathered on deck. "The steamer has gone down," he said, "and every soul on board of her lost." Defiance, Ohio, the 1960s. Born in 1952, Tommy Thompson and Barry Schatz shared the same birthday, April 15th, tax day, and the same day 40 years earlier that the Titanic had gone down to the bottom in an icy sea. They had become friends in the seventh grade when Tommy's family moved to Defiance from Huntington, Indiana. Tommy's father, John, was an engineer. His mother, Phyllis, was a nutritionist. Of four children, Tommy was the youngest, a child always building something or fixing something or tearing something down to build over again. Even at night, with the lights out and a plea from his parents to go to sleep, he would take a flashlight under his covers and continue building with tinker toys. Phyllis said he was the most sleepless child she had ever seen. In the evenings and on weekends, he was in the basement or the garage with his father. John Thompson encouraged questions. He once told his son, "The only reason the engineer is good at what he does is curiosity." Tommy loved it all so much he never wanted to quit, even as a little boy. Tommy came to be known as Harvey when he got to Defiance. He, Barry, and the rest of the group of boys who had dubbed themselves the Vigilantes were selecting nicknames for each other. Tommy liked to travel around, so he nicknamed himself Harvey the Hobo, and the nickname stuck. John Thompson had two brothers who taught philosophy. Phyllis had two brothers who taught engineering and psychology. Tommy often talked to his parents and uncles about education theory and the philosophy of learning. Through this process, he decided that he wanted to think like no one else thought. Although he made the National Honor Society in high school, he sometimes flunked math and science tests because he had to understand a problem conceptually before he went on. Instead of using the accepted formulas and heading in a straight line, he would go around the problem, look at it from different angles, turn it upside down. He did this with everything, and he didn't care how much time it took or what grade he got. He extended his philosophy to his social life, and he did nothing to try to fit in. But his teasing manner and his wackiness usually attracted a crowd. One day, sick at home with mononucleosis, Tommy read an article on vitamin C by Linus Pauling. He called Pauling's office in California and told the renowned doctor that he was doing a high school research project on vitamin C and mononucleosis. Pauling explained to Tommy how the vitamin C worked, how to keep it in his system at the renal threshold, and how to check his urine to see when it spilled over. Tommy then took thousands of milligrams of vitamin C every 4 hours until he reached a dosage of well over 20,000 milligrams a day. 5 days later, he felt so good, he snuck out of his house late at night and orchestrated after-hours bicycle races on the bottom of the country club pool. In the fall of 1970, Tommy enrolled at Ohio State. For years, he had carefully cultivated a creative mindset, worrying that if he ever stopped being different, if he ever stopped experimenting, if he ever stopped pushing and questioning and exploring and looking at life upside down, he would no longer think the thoughts that could lead him to ask the questions no one else had asked, which is what made him unique, which is what allowed him to be what he wanted to be since he was a small boy, an inventor. He wanted to suck the world through his senses and exhale a vision. But a fine line existed in Tommy between calculated antics and true compulsion, and sometimes it was difficult to separate the two. Tommy reveled in so much craziness, his room became a mecca for other students. "You could always count on Harvey for something off the wall," said a friend. "He had a wild-eyed look and curly hair, like a 9-year-old ready to get into anything." The other students liked this stuff so much that 500 of them elected him president of Stradley Hall. But there was another side of Tommy that others rarely saw, and when they did, they weren't sure what to think of it. Sometimes he disappeared for days, and nobody knew where he was. They could believe the goofy Harvey, but they had a hard time with the serious, compulsive Tommy. Ohio State had one of the largest engineering schools in the world. 8,000 students enrolled in 15 departments and graduate schools. Like his father, Tommy had gravitated toward mechanical engineering. "I wanted to be an inventor," he said, "but there is no college training for that. As close as I could get was the mechanical engineering school." He also was determined to be an ocean engineer. Although Ohio State was landlocked and offered no courses in marine engineering, Tommy had intrigued his advisor, the chair of the School of Mechanical Engineering, Don Glauer. Glauer himself was a marine engineer, so he and Tommy designed a major in mechanical engineering with a specialty in machine design and an ocean engineering option, a 5-year program. Glauer exposed Tommy to ideas like entrepreneurship. He told Tommy that inventions were nothing new. "Einstein didn't create anything new," said Glauer. "Everything he did on the theory of relativity was already in the literature, but other physicists just didn't quite see how to put it all together." Glauer's purpose was to challenge Tommy's thinking. In the fall of 1972, Glauer asked Tommy what appeared to be a simple question, yet no one in the world had been able to answer it. "Tom, how are we going to work in the deep ocean?" Although submarines became a critical component of any Navy's arsenal, even nuclear submarines rarely ventured below a few hundred feet, and none could dive below a classified depth of 2,000. Yet the ocean at its deepest could swallow the 29,000 feet of Mount Everest and still have room for over another mile. Even if submarines had been built to dive deeper, the military did not equip them to observe and gather information, because the military wasn't interested in revealing the mysteries of the deep ocean. They only wanted to hide in its vastness. Then in 1963, the Navy's most advanced nuclear submarine, the USS Thresher, had imploded on a routine dive off Nova Scotia and crashed into the sea floor 8,400 feet below, and the Navy had no way to rescue the crew or retrieve the wreckage. For months, they couldn't even find it. The Navy called in the only vessel in the world built to withstand the pressure of the deep ocean, a bathyscaphe called the Trieste, a French-built steel sphere which the Navy recently had purchased and modified. The Trieste was the most sophisticated underwater work technology available, but it could hardly move underwater, had only one claw which repeatedly failed to open, and came with viewing ports so small that the 2-man crew could look out with only one eye at a time. The Navy returned home with photographs and 1 4-foot piece of pipe secured after many frustrating attempts with the Trieste's spastic claw. 9 years later, the deep sea remained an inhospitable foe. We now could descend to the bottom of the deepest ocean and look. We had yet to figure out how to work there. In his senior year, Tommy decided to pursue, at all times, 7 to 14 projects. Some would be long-term, 30 years perhaps, others he might conclude in 2 weeks. He would keep these projects alive to broaden his understanding of science, marketing, technology, business, human behavior, all of the disciplines that come together to make an idea work. At the end of Tommy's 4th year, Dean Glauer arranged for him to be the first engineering student to attend the university's Stone Laboratory at Put-In Bay on Lake Erie. As Tommy neared graduation, Dean Glauer warned him that jobs in ocean engineering were scarce and suggested that the only action might be with treasure hunters down in Key West. Glauer had just read about one named Mel Fisher, who had spent years looking for a Spanish galleon and still hadn't found it. In January 1976, Tommy left Defiance, driving a 63 diesel Mercedes, and wondering how he could get the Mercedes carburetors to feed on French fry oil without choking. Barry Schatz's father had a successful insurance business in Defiance, but Barry didn't like business. His lack of interest showed in his poor grades. He dropped out of Miami University. He dropped out of Ohio University. He went to Quebec, then to Scotland, hitchhiking, drifting, and thinking. When he returned, he enrolled in Hillsdale College in Michigan. He got a job with a local newspaper. 1 quarter short of graduation, Barry had quit school in July 1975 and gone back to Defiance to plan his future. He wanted to team up with Tommy on an adventure they had talked about since high school. Harvey and I had spent a lot of time, he said, dreaming up this plan about going down the Mississippi and getting to Key West by way of boat. When Barry returned home that summer, he called Tommy. They decided to weigh anchor no later than October. But one thing that Barry had learned long ago was that Tommy could focus on his project so completely, he would have no idea what was going on around him. After his August graduation, Tommy had remained in Columbus, juggling his projects, putting off the adventure. But Barry was ready to go. I decided to go, but I was so pissed off at him that I didn't even mention it. I felt bad about not saying anything, but I also thought it was justified, because he's like that all the time. That's part of the relationship. Barry began eating Key West up with a cosmic spoon. He looked like a Latin expatriate, steady, dark brown eyes, thick black mustache, soft-spoken. The Miami Herald was looking for a Key West correspondent. Barry got the job, and the Herald paid him to explore this den of shrimpers and gays and tourists and writers and actors and drug dealers and treasure hunters, all simmering in a mean temperature of 77 degrees. By the time Tommy arrived in January 1976, Barry had just published a story about the Keys' most renowned treasure hunter, Mel Fisher. Mel Fisher was a nearsighted chicken farmer from Indiana and perhaps the most colorful of all the characters in Key West. He had an obsession with diving and a lust for Spanish treasure, and for 7 years he had been chasing an elusive galleon called the Nuestra Señora de Atocha, which sank off the Keys in the hurricane in 1622. His divers had uncovered muskets and swords, religious artifacts, plus 4,000 silver coins, 3 silver bars, a few gold chains, a long gold bar, and a large gold disc and 2 gold coins. But the Atocha had carried 901 silver bars, 15 tons of ingot copper, 250,000 newly minted silver coins, and 161 pieces of gold bullion, plus a myriad of other rare artifacts and finely smithed jewelry and ornamental pieces. The rest of that treasure still lay somewhere at the bottom of the sea, and Fisher was still looking for it. Fisher operated out of an old galleon, a replica down at the Key West dock with a sign on the bow that read, Pirate's Treasure Ship. The Atocha had nothing to do with pirates, but the gimmick attracted tourists at $1.50 a head, which sometimes was the only cash Fisher had to buy food for his divers. When Tommy boarded the galleon in early 1976, he wasn't so much interested in being a diver as he was in talking to Fisher about technology transfers, things that perhaps engineers in the oil industry or some other industry were doing that Fisher might be able to use in searching for shipwrecks. Fisher listened to Tommy's ideas, but he had no money to hire anyone. For the next 6 months, Tommy visited Fisher occasionally while he pursued the 7-14. He didn't care about making a living or having a roof over his head. He just wanted to learn something. The main thing was having enough resources to make phone calls, he said. That was the phenomenon he had discovered with Linus Pauling that would become his link to what was happening in technology all over the world. Scientists like to talk about their work. To save money for phone calls, Tommy sometimes slept in his car. That summer, Tommy was visiting with Fisher one afternoon when he overheard Fisher say he needed someone to man the Theodolite Tower, a lifeguard-like structure that stuck up out of a reef near the quicksands. Someone had to sit on the tower and squint through a surveyor's tool and talk on the radio to keep Fisher's boat on course as it towed a magnetometer back and forth. Tommy told him, "I'll do it," and for the rest of the summer he worked for Mel Fisher. That summer, after thousands of hours with their face masks down in the sand, the divers on the Arbutus found nothing much more valuable than a barrel hoop. Yet they all wanted to be on the bottom because, as one put it, if you're not down there, you're not going to find it. But more and more, Tommy stayed topside. He was more interested in wondering why they couldn't find the Atocha than he was in seeing treasure. For 200 years, fleets of treasure galleons stuffed with silver and gold and emeralds had plied the Caribbean Sea, and every so often one of those unpredictable West Indian cyclones would come spinning across the Caribbean and slam half the fleet onto shallow reefs, which ripped open the hulls and spewed that treasure all over the ocean floor. Where were these wrecks, and why were they so hard to find? Already, shipwrecks had become one of the 7-14, and Tommy was asking more questions. Tommy had liked Mel Fisher from the day he met the man, but Fisher would blast holes into the seafloor, and within days or even hours, sand would again fill the holes, and Fisher would have no record of where he had just searched. Amazing the way that place worked, said Tommy. Absolutely incredible. I got to see a lot of the problems. They had dragged a magnetometer all over the quicksands, and every time they'd get a hit, remembered Tommy, someone would shout, "Yeah, that's it! That's got to be it! Send the divers down!" Then they would mark the spot by throwing over a bleach bottle tied to a cinder block. As soon as the weather turned rough, the bleach bottle buoys would drift. This had been going on for years, said Tommy, and Mel's operation was better than most. And another thing Tommy pondered. How did Fisher know the Atocha had not been salvaged shortly after it sank, 350 years ago? The water wasn't that deep. The technology was there centuries ago to salvage it. As Tommy watched Fisher's operation and listened to stories about other treasure hunters, he began to see a pattern. They operated from day to day, with no long-term plan. They were all underfunded. No one kept accurate records. Investors were unhappy and filing lawsuits. The state claimed all treasure belonged to it, and storms scattered a ship's remains sometimes for miles across the shallow sea. They had no way of telling whether an artifact came from their target ship or from some other ship which had landed on top of it in another storm. They could never be sure that no one else had already salvaged the ship that they were after. Tommy's thoughts and observations about shipwrecks in the Caribbean began to fill notebooks. In the fall of 1976, Tommy left for Columbus to work on a solar energy project. Next, he went to Texas to consult with a startup company, then east to New York, and back over to Chicago. He earned just enough money consulting to put diesel fuel into the Mercedes and pay off the two phone cards he used when he stayed with family and friends. The winter of 77, he lived in Chicago with his sister Sandy and his brother-in-law Milt Butterworth, who supervised the lighting and photography of art objects at the Chicago Art Institute. Much of his time there he spent on the phone. These phone calls were very important to him, remembered Sandy. A matter of life and death. In Chicago, two men he had met while working for Mel Fisher introduced him to a treasure hunter named John Deering. Deering was funny, unassuming, easy to be around, and he admired Tommy's engineering skills. A year after they met, Deering called Tommy about his latest venture, La Concepcion, the legendary wreck on Silver Shoals about 80 miles off the coast of the Dominican Republic. The Concepcion had gone down in 1641 with a registered consignment of 150 tons of treasure, mostly silver. Deering worked for Seaborne Ventures, and he was in Seattle trying to overhaul a 157-foot minesweeper called the James Bay. They needed an engineer to get her running and sail with them down to Panama, through the locks and into the Caribbean Sea. Tommy signed on. As he had with Mel Fisher, Tommy watched closely how the Seaborne Ventures was run. When the James Bay left Seattle in late July 1978, 3 months after the projected departure date, Deering's partners were still trying to raise money for the expedition. While the James Bay lay off Panama, Tommy flew back to Miami, then to Texas and Columbus and Chicago, tending his 7 to 14 flock. In September, Deering heard that a treasure-hunting rival named Bert Weber had just arrived in the Dominican Republic, signed a contract with the government, found the wreck of the Concepcion, and was now salvaging her tons of silver. With Christmas nearing, they returned to Key West to raise money and mobilize for a new project. Tommy spent little time in Key West now. He continued working around the country on various projects, solar energy and infinitely variable speed transmission, an amphibious bus, earning just enough to eat and pay for his phone bills. As Tommy had watched the treasure hunters searching for shipwrecks around shallow water reefs, he wondered about the technology needed to recover shipwrecks from the deep ocean. For if he had the capability to descend thousands of feet, sift delicately through the remains of an ancient ship, and bring back her treasure unmarred, he had the means to do almost anything on the bottom. Fish, farm, mine, drill, recover, test, save, explore, collect, all of the things that he and Glauer had discussed. The same forces had to be overcome. When Tommy learned that big mining companies had banded together to share the cost of developing ocean technology, deep ocean mining became one of the 7 to 14. Deep water submersibles already had imaged mineral-rich manganese nodules scattered across the ocean floor, but the mining companies needed better technology to collect the nodules cost-effectively. He read whatever he could find on their work and spoke on the phone with several of the people involved. Ever since the Thresher tragedy, submersibles could go deeper and deeper, but they still could perform only the same crude functions: observe, photograph, film, grab, and hold. There seemed to be a barrier that no one could penetrate. Glauer himself had labeled the barrier impossible. About this time, Tommy wrote down two questions. By the year 2000, what kind of technology will be available to find and recover ships lost in the deep ocean? And what prevents us from doing that at a reasonable cost right now? As he talked with other scientists and engineers, he asked these questions repeatedly.